to The Loins of History, a podcast that connects the past to the present and corrects historical and political illiteracy. I'm your host, Colin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jay. And we're going to continue our mini-series on the Civil War and pick up where Jay left off talking about the antebellum South. And now we're into the Civil War, and Jay is going to take us through why the South lost the Civil War. Before Jay gets into the key takeaways, I want to give a couple shout-outs to some comments we had on YouTube, actually, to Robert Stewart and David McLeod. And David, thank you for correcting us on Birmingham, but we're going to have to correct you that Jay and I are both native Southerners, and we have been here since pre-18th century, so our families go back way, way, way back in the Southeast, so... Got to correct you on that point but Jay,
we're glad. Thanks for the feedback, man. yeah, for sure. No, appreciate the comments for sure. His correction to us was, I think I had mentioned Birmingham as being a city and during the Civil War, and he was like, no, Birmingham didn't exist. And he's from Alabama. So thanks, David, for the correction. Just as a quick recap, you know, last episode was really a summary of what the Old South was as a culture and kind of arguing for it existing as an independent civilization, not merely politically speaking as it did during, you know, the Civil War, but in terms of its culture, in terms of its structure, in terms of its economy. There were so many unique things that are like, you can still see some of the artifacts in the South today, but a lot of it was different. This episode is going to focus on, okay, you have the Old South. Why did it fall? Why did it collapse? Because this is a larger series on the fall of civilizations, and we're really kind of looking at all these different examples to really ask the question, why does this happen, and what lessons can we be? What can we learn for today? So obviously everyone knows about the Civil War, and this episode is not going to be a recap of the Civil War. We're really going to focus on, you know, kind of answering some big questions, you know, really the why the South lost the Civil War. It's going to, you know, we'll touch on why the North won, but again, this series is on why the South as a civilization fell. So three key takeaways for this episode. The first one is the South had failed to modernize over the 1800s. Number two, the South let its prejudices get in the way of effective war fighting. And number three, the South had lost its way of life during the Civil War. And we'll kind of talk about the destruction of plantation society and how Sherman's March to the Sea, really, it wasn't just simply a military defeat. It really cut to the core of what Southern culture was at that time and basically wiped it off the face of the earth. I'm going to do something a little bit different than the last episode, and that is because I leaned so heavily, just full disclosure, I leaned extremely heavily on one resource. So I wanted to give the book recommendation at the beginning, just so y'all know, the main resource that I used is and book recommendation for this week is James McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom. It is by far the best single volume work on the Civil War. It is nearly 900 pages, and it is so good. He writes at length on how the Civil War, like the causes, and he's extremely fair. He doesn't grind an axe either for or against the South, for or against the North. He just kind of lays the facts as they are. He really was the main resource for this episode. Okay, with that, and kind of segueing from McPherson, I wanted to give an overview of kind of the main school, the main schools of thought for why the South lost the war. And McPherson talks about this. It is to this day extremely controversial. There are so many different explanations out there, various amalgamations of different views, and they kind of take from one and borrow from the other and kind of get these different things. We're going to talk about it. The first school of thought is known as the Lost Cause. Sometimes you'll hear it referred to as the Lost Cause thesis. But the Lost Cause became popularized in 1866. So like immediately after the war, and it has been an ongoing Southern explanation for why the South lost the war. Now, there's a lot more to the Lost Cause than simply why the South lost the war. There's a lot of it includes why the war started in the first place, and I won't spend too much time in this episode talking about that because we talked about it in our first episode. But in short, the Lost Cause thesis for why the South lost the war was that it was inevitable that the South would lose simply due to the size of Northern manpower, Northern resources, Northern finances. And no matter what the South did, they were going to eventually lose. One soldier was quoted as, you know, saying it wasn't a fair fight. And what another aspects of the Lost Cause is specifically focused on Robert E. Lee and how he's kind of maintained, more so than any other figure in the South, as being like this hero. And it wasn't Lee's fault in the Lost Cause. Rather, it was all of his subordinates. He had all these various subordinates, of which Longstreet gets the worst of it. And Longstreet was I believe he was a division commander, but he was a subordinate commander at Gettysburg. And, you know, after Jackson was killed at Chancellorsville, Lee really didn't have that main subordinate that he could rely upon. And Longstreet kind of filled that role and didn't do so great, as the Lost Cause articulates. I'm going to go through all of these causes, and then I'll kind of come back and kind of talk about what my view is, what our view is, and what McPherson says. The second school of thought for why the South lost the war is the internal weaknesses school of thought. This is really popular from Northern/non-Southern historians, historians that are not necessarily sympathetic to the South. And they kind of see it as like, yeah, the North was superior in a lot of other, you know, metrics, but the real reason why y'all in the South lost that war was because of your internal weaknesses. They talk about the class divide between, you know, in plantation aristocracy, about how you had the wealthy, the cotton plantation owners, and then you had the poor whites and, of course, the slaves. There was this large disparity, and, you know, it was the South lost because it was a rich man's war being fought on behalf of, or being fought by poor white people from the South. So there's, you know, that class distinction is one internal division. You know, they point to the moral weaknesses, you know, from a religious aspect. You know, both sides in the Civil War claimed a religious superiority, that they were fighting on God's side. But, you know, this internal weaknesses argument kind of says, like, your religious views is contradictory to reality. That provides a moral shortcoming. That's why y'all lost the war, etc. The third school of thought really places a heavy emphasis in his, you could think of it as the Northern leadership dynamic or argument. And that is basically saying really beginning in 1863, Northern leadership was infinitely superior to Southern leadership. You know, you still had guys like Lee, but once Jackson was killed, you know, this view kind of basically says like the South was run by a bunch of imbeciles. Jefferson Davis is not put in a very good light. The two Johnstons, Braxton Bragg, a lot of guys are not seen as not just good military commanders, but not governed well either. And in contrast to that, you have, you know, Grant coming to be not the commander in chief, because that was still Abraham Lincoln, but basically the senior military commander of all Union forces. William Tecumseh Sherman taking over in the Army of Tennessee and taking over the Army of Georgia later. And this argument basically says, like, once the North was able to figure out its early leadership issues, it was inevitable that the North was going to win. All three of these views have weaknesses to them. You know, obviously the glaring weakness of the Lost Cause is that there's this very intense emotional component that, you know, it refuses to look at the South's own issues, and it just says, like, we lost because it wasn't fair. Victor Davis Hanson, in his book Ripples of Battle, gives a really good example of this, the specific thought, and talks about how it's emotionally compelling, but it doesn't really stand up to the facts. At the Battle of Shiloh, which was in Tennessee, and it was really the first battle that Sherman got a claim at, but it was a outnumbered Southern army went on a surprise attack and completely surprised Grant at the time, had Grant reeling. And the Confederate general in charge was a guy named Albert Sidney Johnston. And right at like the crescendo of this battle, Johnston gets shot in his leg. And he later bleeds out and dies. And essentially what that did is that kind of sucked the wind out of the Confederate army, says the Lost Cause thesis, and the people that were his subordinates were a bunch of idiots because Johnston had led the surprise attack. You know, everything had gone really well for the Confederates at that point, but then Johnston died, a single bullet hit him in his leg, bled out. And then almost immediately after that, the next day, Sherman goes on the counterattack. You have the Union Army just reinforces itself and then completely obliterates the Southern Army after that. And the Lost Cause thesis, as Hanson writes, basically says, like, man, if Johnston just wouldn't have died, they would have won that battle. And if they had won that battle, then Sherman's march to, you know, capture of Atlanta and Sherman's march to the sea would have never happened, because they would have gotten bogged down in Tennessee. And and if Sherman's march to the sea would have never happened, you know, blah, 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 could have won the war. And it was only because Albert Sidney Johnston got shot in the leg and it's just this very romantic, like, oh, we were so close.
had Jackson not gotten shot by his own troops at Chancellorsville. Chancellorsville was a masterstroke battle for Lee and Jackson, but he was killed by his own troops. And then you think in Gettysburg, kind of similar to Shiloh, like the first day, the Confederates had the Union reeling back into the city of Gettysburg, and they were in, I'm trying to think how it was initially described. It was basically just pulling back in a disordered retreat and withdrawing back into the city. And General Ewell, who had taken over in a similar role and where Jackson would have been, didn't charge and pursue. If Jackson was there, I've heard arguments being made that had Jackson been at Gettysburg, the Confederates would have pushed the attack and taken the initiative and probably scattered the Union army before it was able to reinforce itself. And then suddenly now go, you know, fortify, go on the offensive at that point and take the battle. And obviously they won Gettysburg. And I think you mentioned it later where that's kind of a turning point in the war, but it's very similar. I think the lost cause and the internal weaknesses have some validity, but I kind of look at them like, it wasn't a lost cause, but it was a monumental task. And for internal weaknesses, you mentioned plenty of other smaller nations have won. Well, yeah, but most of them don't win, right? It's like the majority of small nations being attacked by a larger one lose like 9 times out of 10. And that's why we recognize that the ones that did win, you know, the United States is a perfect example of that. And I'll kind of compare those, the U.S. Revolution against the British, to this later. But I think they missed the point that, like in the lost cause, like, no, it really wasn't a lost cause from the get-go. There were some very difficult conversations between Lincoln and Grant and his generals. There was points where the Union thought that they may not win this war. They thought it was going to be quick. At the Battle of Manassas, there were Union spectators who came to watch the Union rout the Confederates because they thought it was going to be one battle and over. And they were routed at the battle. And then with internal weaknesses, right. I mean, there were a lot of inept, I don't even want to say inept, but Confederate generals who were not up to the task because it was such a monumental effort. You needed generals like Lee and Jackson and Johnston and all of these others to stay alive during the course of the war in order to finish it out. Because we may look at it at the Battle of Shiloh and say, well, Johnston, these other idiots took over for Johnston when he died and they couldn't win the battle. It's like, well, it's not like common sense to think of how Johnston would have fought the battle and how he would have pursued. And the average general would have lost that battle handily, probably.
Yeah.
So I think that's the kind of perspective we have to have with those first two.
Yeah. And I think Hansen makes this argument. It's even if Johnston would have survived, they still probably would have lost that battle. But the whole like emotional impetus behind the lost cause was just that it was like, we were so close and we just got, you know, it's not that we, the South, the Confederacy was doing anything wrong. It's that, you know, all of these things outside of our control are why we lost. And I think that is the fallacy behind, and what's honestly, what's not helpful. If you refuse to accept that you actually made some mistakes, you're never going to fix your mistakes and you're never going to be able to get beyond that. Which is kind of in a sense, that's really my main argument here in talking about the fall of the antebellum South is it, you know, it has this tragic component to it because it didn't have to happen. There were several, you know, almost infinite number of decisions that could have been different. And the South could have maintained its way of life in different ways. But instead, you know, there were poor decisions made. And then in retrospect, a lot of Southerners refused to acknowledge what those poor decisions were, and nothing gets solved that way. Kind of moving on to the – go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, and then the gradual development of superior Northern leadership, I feel like that's extremely biased. I mean, the leaders that were in the Union generals were, it's not like they just appeared out of nowhere. They just materialized out of some ethereal vapor of liberty and Union greatness. It's like Grant and Sherman, they were generals within the Union Army from the beginning. They were promoted after incompetence. Right. You know, many of the generals beforehand were fired by Lincoln personally, like after Fredericksburg and other terrible campaigns that were being waged. But they were part of the Union Army. Like they were part of the massive force. And I mean, most of those generals also served alongside the Confederate generals in like the Mexican-American War and others. So like they were basically all peers together and probably knew each other. If the Civil War hadn't happened, they probably would have been friends and on like first name basis with each other, dating back to their time at West Point.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think they were friends and on first name basis with one another before the war, and probably corresponded with each other after the war. The next thing I want to do is to kind of summarize what McPherson argues. And he doesn't call it this, but I'm going to call it his contingency view, because his main argument is that the main weakness of the three earlier versions that we just talked about are that they lack a view of contingency, i.e., they kind of see everything as inevitable. And there's this fatalistic aspect, which is extremely common in the historical profession, to kind of see, you know, things as inevitable, because you just naturally look back on it in hindsight and think like, oh, of course it was supposed to turn out that way, blah, 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 blah. And I think McPherson rightfully argues for, no, we don't have to be fatalists. We can actually say, like, you know, there was a chance. There absolutely was a chance that the South could have won the war. And interestingly enough, like, it's kind of weird that Southerners say, like, there's no way we could have won the war, because that's kind of like putting yourself down, you know? Whereas the contingency view says, like, no, you could have won. There were chances. There were plenty of chances. And some of it were inside your realm of control, and other things were outside your realm of control. And it's just complicated and it's messy. And what McPherson does is he kind of outlines basically four key points that define the conduct of the war. The first one kind of determined that it was going to be a drawn out war, and the next three kind of determined that the Union was going to win the war as things gone on. But at all four of these points in time, it wasn't inevitable. Like, it could have gone either way each time. And of course, there's a host of other points in the war that could have impacted. But his main four points that he sees as being like the key points of the war are the summer of 1862, when in the Northern, you know, theater, the Virginia theater, Lee and Jackson's victories, and Generals Bragg and Kirby Smith in the West, they kind of checked some early Union advances. Those Southern victories ensure that the war was not going to be over quickly. That's point number one. Point number two is the fall of 1862 at the battles of Antietam and Perryville. Those battles were losses for the Confederacy. But there were also some key diplomatic and political outcomes of those two battles. You know, the war had been basically going on for less than 12 months. The Confederacy had scored some early victories, but at Antietam and Perryville, it was like, maybe now the South's not going to win a quick victory and that kind of thing. And the South could have won in the same way that the North could have won at Bull Run and Manassas, but they didn't.
It's interesting. Like, at Bull Run, if you look at a map to look at how close Manassas is to the capital, I mean, it's what, like, less than 50 miles probably to the capital, just off the top of my head. It's like 2 days ride probably. Like, the army could have been there in 2 or 3 days. So, like, after that battle, there was a legitimate fear of the Union. They were actually, some of the forces were retreating back into D.C. So there was like this, holy cow, like the Confederates just won. They're only a few miles outside of our capital. So, like, there was a legit fear from the Union that they might capitulate quickly. Maybe not capitulate, but, you know, they might be in an awkward position when D.C. gets attacked by these upstart rebels.
I actually didn't plan to say this, but if you study Stonewall Jackson's Shenandoah Valley campaign, it is insane. Like, what that dude and what that army accomplished, shocked everyone. It is one of the most impressive military campaigns, definitely in American history. Europeans, which at that time they definitely snubbed their nose at the U.S. military, they studied Jackson's Shenandoah Valley campaign. Just his ability to not just survive, but completely decimate larger Union armies was so impressive. That wasn't inevitable, right? Like to the contingency point here, it's like the fact that he accomplished that is insane. And literally nobody can look back on that campaign and go, it was inevitable. No, it was, you know, a Southern army beating Union forces time and time and time again, fair and square. So it's kind of like the lost cause argument doesn't accept that and kind of goes like, it wasn't a fair fight. It's like, you guys schwacked them there in the beginning. The other two things real quick in the fall of 62, like what Antietam and Perryville did was, you know, certain European powers, Great Britain, most notably, were not exactly on friendly terms with Washington, D.C. at that time and prior to. You know, the War of 1812 wasn't that far removed. And when the Confederacy was trying to cozy up with those European powers, you know, they were considering it. Everything from like supplying arms to actual intervention. But when the South lost at Antietam, they were kind of like, we don't know how this is going to turn out. So McPherson argues that Antietam and Perryville kept Europe out of the war. It prevented Europe from recognizing the Confederacy as an independent state, which would have been huge. And that obviously, you know, helped the North out quite a bit. And the last thing that happened in fall 62 was the elections. So there was a congressional election that, you know, the war had already not turned out the way. And the Democratic Party was alive and well in the North at this time. It wasn't just like Republicans having a monopoly on politics. Like, you know, the Republicans won one presidential election in 1860. 1862 is not that far removed. And the quote unquote peace Democrats were very much in favor of an armistice. They wanted union, but they didn't necessarily want to wage the war that Lincoln was waging. The third point is the summer and fall of 1863. So kind of fast forward a year. You had three main battles that occurred. You had Gettysburg, Vicksburg, and Chattanooga, kind of the main three, you know, three areas. So like Vicksburg was the precursor to the taking over Mobile Bay. Chattanooga was the precursor to taking Atlanta. And Gettysburg, of course, was, you know, ended Robert E. Lee's incursion into the North. The fourth point here is the summer of 1864, which is when Atlanta fell to Sherman. Sherman then immediately turned to his march to the sea, which was, you know, his scorched earth campaign from Atlanta to Savannah. And then he later, at the end of 64 and into 65, turned north and did his Carolinas campaign where he burnt Columbia, South Carolina. And then ultimately, I think he was trying to go up to Goldsboro, North Carolina. Also split off and did some stuff at Wilmington as well, Wilmington, North Carolina. The summer of 64 just completely obliterated the South's ability to wage war. Go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, I was going to say that. A point about, you mentioned turn the tide in the summer and fall of 63. I think it's important to note that just because at this point, after those battles, the Union was winning the war and the tide was definitely in their favor militarily, the South was still very much willing to fight and wage war, whether that was whether their capacity to wage war was still in, you know, with Lee's incursions into the North or maintaining a stronghold in the Southeast where they could keep the Union forces out, maybe not, but they were still willing, and the populace of the South was still in support of the war. Now, 64, so within, before the spring campaigns of 64, they got into what was called by Mark Grimsley the doctrine of hard war. And this was basically we're no longer going to fight the battle. We're no longer going to win the war by fighting the Confederates in battle. We will if it comes to that, but we're going to take the war to the Southern populace and take them out of the war, because if they don't want to fight anymore, then the South has no cause. There is no rebel cause anymore. So, and here's, I'm going to read a quote of what Sherman, the orders that he gave to Sherman before he began his march to the sea and his campaigns of scorched earth. "You, I propose to move against Johnston's army, to break it up and to get into the interior of the enemy's country as far as you can, inflicting all the damage you can against their war resources. I do not propose to lay down for you a plan of campaign, but simply to lay down the work it is desirable to have done, and leave you free to execute in your own way. Submit to me, however, as early as you can, your plan of operations." Basically, if anybody's ever been in the military, he basically laid out his intent to say, like, go to war against their resources. So their people, their food, their supply lines, their ammunition, take away all of that from them so that they are incapable, destroy their morale. So, and to this point, after he captured Atlanta and started marching to the sea, I mean, he really did just destroy the morale. There's different quotes out there. I think there's a lot of quotes from different unnamed soldiers and population of just talking about the pure devastation, how the Union burned everything, and once rich men were now begging for bread, and soldiers would look around and just see that what once was a city is now a devastated wasteland, talking about like Atlanta and some of the others. So that broke the back of the South, and within – what, 9 months-ish from the capture of Atlanta, 9-10 months, the Confederacy eventually surrendered.
Yeah, the war was over. Yeah, no, you're right. I think McPherson does a really good job arguing, like, none of these things were inevitable, but that's why the South lost the war. Like, at some point, you got to put your foot down and say, like, okay, here's the reasons why you can't. You know, if the fatalist historian commits the error of going too far in one direction, the right answer is not going in the complete opposite direction and saying, like, oh, you can't tell why. And I think McPherson does a really good job of saying, like, yes, like, by the time of the fourth point here, the summer of 64 and on into the winter, like, it was basically game over at that point. And just to help remind our listeners, the Lee surrendered in April of 65. Johnston surrendered in like a couple weeks later in April. I want to say the very last Confederate military force surrendered in like May or June.
It was in Citronelle, Alabama.
Right. Yeah.
It's random. My wife and I were just driving through some back roads in Alabama, and we passed one of those historical markers, and it was like, here lies the last spot or the last surrender, you know, the last army's surrender, you know, the Confederate army. I was like, huh, Citronelle, Alabama. Okay.
Citronelle, Alabama. Yeah. Yeah. The conduct of the war in the West was turned very much guerrilla. After that, there's a great book by a friend of mine, actually, called The Uncivil War, Guerrilla Warfare in Missouri during the Civil War, written by a guy named Robert Mackey. He really focuses on Missouri. He's a native Missourian. And just like the guerrilla warfare that goes on in that area is wild. You have bushwhackers and jayhawkers that are just like killing each other, like almost like gangs. It's like, oh, you're a jayhawker? Like, I will murder you and your family. Done. There was no like military strategy per se behind it, other than just like inflict as many casualties and as much pain as possible. So, you know, that's why it was it kind of one of the last places to surrender, because it wasn't necessarily like organized, you know, Army of Northern Virginia versus the Army of the Potomac type deal. It was very guerrilla and irregular in the Western theater. Okay.
Can I make the quick point that a couple weeks ago on one of the previous episodes, you brought up Thucydides. That's a tough word to say. Thucydides. When the Athenians were talking to the island of Melos and the Melians, and it was the strong do as they will, the weak endure what they must. I think going the spring campaigns of 64 and what Sherman was told by Ulysses S. Grant is kind of echoing. It kind of has echoes of that, of like, they're not going to surrender until we, the stronger, decide to destroy them. Because you were talking about guerrilla warfare, and, you know, though the tide was against them, like, what if they had just, this is kind of those what ifs of history, but like, had Sherman and had Grant not decided to go into this hard war doctrine, the Confederacy could have elongated this war another 4 years, right? Than what, Lincoln's out of office. Now you have a new political power. Maybe they're not as favorable on the war. Maybe they've gotten tired of it. I think in our modern day society, we've seen how unpopular wars, which are much less costly in a human capital perspective, are once they start to drag out over a couple months, let alone a few years. So I think that that quote by Thucydides is very applicable here, because like, it's true. Like, in order to win, like, the strong do what they must.
Yeah. No, it's almost like you read my notes, Colin. That's a great segue into our next point. And it really is the, like, you know, if you want to maintain your way of life, which for the South, that's what they were trying to do, you have to be strong. You can't presume upon the moral superiority of your weakness to keep you safe. And when I say weakness, I mean like if a foreign, you know, from the Southern perspective, if a foreign power calls up 75,000 soldiers to come invade your country, and if you're not able to respond, that's a weakness, or at least respond in an enduring manner. They responded initially for sure, but they obviously lost the war. I want to get into just the three main reasons that I will supplement McPherson's view here. Like, I think he's right talking about, you know, these were the four key points chronologically, but I kind of want to supplement maybe a little bit more broadly with some things. And the first one is what we're talking about now. And that is, the South did not modernize. And I mean that in the broadest sense, not possible, but in a very broad sense. Like, it wasn't just modernized culturally. There's a great, I can't remember if I mentioned this in our last episode, but in the movie Gone with the Wind, Rhett Butler's character kind of walks in on this Southern gentry meeting where they're talking about, like, there's going to be war. Like, Lincoln's called up the 75,000. We're going to whip those Yankees all the way back to New York or whatever. And Rhett Butler goes, he's like, with what, sticks? Or something to that effect. And he's like, there isn't a single cannon factor in the entire South. How are you going to win this war? And it's a really good example where it's like, you can have all the hubris in the world, but if you don't have the industry, if you didn't modernize, if your military force still relies upon like good old cavalry charges with a saber, when there's a thing called grape shot in an artillery cannon, of which Napoleon, 40 years earlier, 45, 50 years earlier, used to devastating effect, just completely blasting holes in cavalry brigades and infantry regiments. It's like massing your forces and doing these like physical type charges is just a recipe for disaster at this age of warfare. And this, that's what the South, you know, relied upon. They saw themselves as these knights. Let me read a paragraph real quick from McPherson. And this paragraph kind of illustrates why the South didn't modernize. McPherson writes, "Thus, when the secessionists protested that they were acting to preserve traditional rights and values, they were correct. They fought to protect their constitutional liberties against the perceived Northern threat to overthrow them. The South's concept of republicanism had not changed in three quarters of a century. The North's had. With complete sincerity, the South fought to preserve its version of the Republic of the Founding Fathers, a government of limited powers that protected the rights of property, in whose constituency comprised an independent gentry and yeomanry of the white race, undisturbed by large cities, heartless factories, restless free workers, and class conflict. The accession to power of the Republican Party, with its ideology of competitive, egalitarian, free labor capitalism, was a signal to the South that the Northern majority had turned irrevocably towards this frightening revolutionary future. Indeed, the Black Republican Party, which, by the way, the Black Republican Party was a Democrat Party pejorative against Republicans. They're trying to paint the Republican Party as being super friendly to blacks. Indeed, the Black Republican Party appeared to the eyes of many Southerners as essentially a revolutionary party composed of, quote, a motley throng of sans-culottes, infidels, and free lovers interspersed by bloomer women, fugitive slaves, and amalgamationists, end quote. Therefore, still McPherson here, therefore, secession was a preemptive counter-revolution to prevent the Black Republican Revolution from engulfing the South. We are not revolutionists, insisted James B.D. Debo and Jefferson Davis during the Civil War. They said, we are resisting revolution. We are conservative. I think this is a very good and very fair paragraph talking about like the South didn't modernize because it saw modernization as a threat, and it saw the changes that were coming with the Industrial Revolution and the social reforms that were coming with that as terrifying to its way of life. And they intentionally didn't do that. The unfortunate reality, you know, unfortunate from the Southern perspective, was that that modernization gave the North a significant advantage in the war that the South just wasn't able to overcome. I think, you know, if I was to argue against myself here, it's like, at the end of the day, you know, okay, the South didn't modernize, but the Southern way of life at that time was still superior from like a moral standpoint. Like it was morally better. And the wage slaves up North had a terrible way of life. And just because they were more powerful doesn't make them right. It doesn't make them better. It just means that, you know, especially when put couched in religious terms, you know, this view of like, oh no, we're supposed to suffer, like the righteous suffer. And it doesn't, the fact that we're suffering, it doesn't make us inherently wrong or inherently evil. My only thought on that argument, that's fair. But my only thought is like, okay, it still may be better, but at the end of the day, the way of life was eliminated. Like if I still can't give up the ground to say, like, if you want to maintain your way of life, you need to be able to defend it and defend it with force as necessary. I'm not trying to make an argument that the South should have won the Civil War. I actually agree with Woodrow Wilson. I was reading again in McPherson. He quotes Woodrow Wilson talking about how he was quoted as saying, like, I'm glad the South lost the war as a Southerner, because can you imagine there being two different states here? Like I love, and Wilson says this, he's like, I love the South, and that's why I'm glad they lost the war, because the South is, you know, the Union, the United States today is better off because it has the South in it. It was fundamentally a good thing that the Union was preserved. But with all that being said, just kind of thinking about lessons learned here for our fall of civilizations, and like, if you want to protect your way of life, you need to be able to defend it. And a very large part of being able to defend it means keeping up with the times. Maybe you should have built an artillery factory in somewhere in the South.
Yeah, from a purely evolutionary standpoint, if you look at it like that, it's like, well, the strongest survive, you know, survival of the fittest. Like, your civilization lost to another in a clash of civilizations, which is kind of what we're talking about, all of the antebellum mm-hmm. South, it was just not able to preserve itself. We can, like you mentioned, we can argue the morality of it. Should it have done this way? Should it have not gone this way? Did they have a right to exist? Blah, you know, on and on and on. At the end of the day, someone stronger came along and they won the war.
Right.
It's kind of as simple as that.
Yeah. I'll bring it up now because we actually, Colin and I were talking about this before we started recording, but Colin brought up Agincourt and how the French knights were extremely arrogant and charged across this muddy field because they saw the British longbowmen as morally inferior, right? And they were using a coward's weapon and they had their heavy armor and they just got slaughtered.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, go for it.
I was going to say the longbowmen were generally lower birth. Like, if you think about it from that perspective, like the knights were from a long lineage of wealthy landowners, warrior. They were a warrior class who had centuries of chivalry and fighting bred into them and trained. And these longbowmen were essentially peasants who had trained. It's interesting. Like, I think they've done studies on like the bone structure of longbowmen and how like their arms, like, the bones, even in the muscles, were like really thick, because it's very difficult to pull back these longbows. Like, it's not as simple as people see on like what, you know, whatever show we watch now, but it's very difficult to pull back. But they're still of low birth, and you know, that's all the training it took. And it's cheap. You didn't have to be wealthy, but you're right. An outnumbered army, English army at Agincourt defeated a superior numeric and more heavily armored and, you know, superior physically, morally, whatever you want to call it, army. And they won. They won that day. And it essentially ended like kind of a way of life of knighthood. Like, knights were no longer perceived after that battle as these invincible, game-changing, you know, military men of this kind of the end of the middle. Well, wasn't the end of the Middle Ages, but it was the end of an era as far as knights go are concerned. They were no longer feared on the battle as these invincible warriors.
Right. Yeah. The give a little teaser to the next series that I'm going to take the lead on. I'm going to be talking about the fall of the French Third Republic. And it's this exact same idea of like, you know, the Third Republic utterly and completely just collapsed in 1940 when Heinz Guderian led his tanks through the Ardennes and completely caught the French by surprise. It was, you know, not just did the French army collapse, but like the entire Third Republic. And Adolf Hitler, you know, went and, you know, had them sign their surrender in the very train car that they made the Germans sign the Treaty of Versailles. And it's like this extremely like, okay, why did France fall? It's, and their army, like they were, the army did not modernize. They did not keep up with the times. They were still thinking in terms of 1917 and 1918. And it's like, when you do that, you risk your, you compromise your own self-defense. Okay. Next point here for why kind of my augmentation for why the South lost the war here, and that is Southern prejudices prevented them from making decisions that would help them win the war. The first one, and a huge one here, is that the North started enlisting freed black men in the army shortly after the announcement of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. The South, who had way more significant manpower shortfalls than the North did not allow slaves to fight until March of 1865, the month before Lee surrendered at Appomattox. And it's like, that's the most like, you know, especially when you consider, you know, other aspects about the lost cause thesis that I didn't cover there in the beginning, but one of the main tenets was that slavery was benevolent, right? That like it uplifted the station of the black race and it gave them a better way of life and that they appreciated slavery, which is obviously not true, but that's part of the lost cause thesis. And it's like, well, if that's the case, why didn't you let the slaves fight to maintain their uplifted station? And it's just like, it's so blatantly obvious that there's this prejudice here. And it's like the North, who didn't have the same manpower considerations. I mean, conscription was extremely unpopular. The movie Gangs in New York is fantastic, but it, you know, it kind of plays on that theme on, you know, a lot of the wartime measures. Irish rifles. Right. Like a lot of the wartime measures, even in the North, were not popular, but, and they let the, you know, black people fight. And the South didn't do it. And it's like, why? Like that doesn't make any sense. That's one. Another Southern prejudice that kept them from effective war fighting is that the Southerners were overconfident in King Cotton, right? The cash crop, king, cotton is king, right? And they were, one of the ways in which that overconfidence was expressed was they thought that Europeans like couldn't live without cotton. And that they would do whatever it took to maintain their access to Southern cotton. Yeah, they were overconfident that Europeans would be desperate for their cotton and would do anything that it took to maintain their access to it. You know, they thought too highly of themselves, and that was deeply rooted in, you know, they saw that their plantation economy and their agricultural was like morally superior, and that they thought that that would just win over the Europeans. And that was not the case. The Europeans needed more than that, and they stayed out of it, and they found, you know, found their ability to get fabric, from, elsewhere. Another prejudice, is, just kind of like the class distinction. I kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier, but, you know, the burden of the war was very much falling on the lower class down in the South, as opposed to up North. And one really interesting example of how even in the South, they were kind of blind to this view, this prejudice. And that is, there was a law called the 20 Negro Law. And when conscription really started in the South, there was this exemption made, that if you owned 20 slaves or more, you were exempted from conscription. Well, the problem with that is like all the wealthy Southerners were exempt from conscription, and they didn't have to go fight the war. And a really interesting dynamic here, just to kind of illustrate the difference, is so immediately after, from 1865 to 1871, Paraguay, however you say it, in South America, fought a war against like Brazil and Uruguay and like all these other, like this coalition of other South American countries. And they ended up losing 80% of their military aged males and 50% of their entire population during this war. 80% of their military aged males, like literally everyone in that country fought to the death just to maintain their independence. They still lost the war, but just as an example, 80% died in that war. In the South, only 25% of the military aged male population died in the war. And I'm not trying to diminish the tragedy of that, because as fellow Americans, like that's awful, but it just kind of illustrates that like the fighting age white male population was not as fully invested as it could have been. And this, and the class distinctions there is part of it. Two more prejudices here. Southerners, not only did they look down on African Americans, but they looked down on Northerners, and they saw that they're like, these Northerners, like they're a bunch of you know, cowards. They're not going to have the will to fight. They're just naturally inferior, because they saw themselves as like, you know, these knights, and that obviously was wrong. And the Southerners like grossly underestimated what the Northern will to fight would be for the long term. Last thing, politically speaking, you know, we talked in our last episode about how Southerners' political view, this Federalist view, was very much big on decentralized government, and the Confederacy had a very difficult time The Confederate government based out of Richmond had a very difficult time mobilizing all of the different Confederate states, just because they saw, no, the primary thing is the state and leave it up to the Confederacy. Whereas the North, on the other hand, did almost the exact opposite. They reformed a central bank. They had a national currency. They were, you know, Abraham Lincoln was very heavy-handed in mobilizing the North, and it worked. Like, they were able to get a lot of people armed down South, whereas the South was not able to do that exact same thing. All of those things are tied to biases and prejudices that the South just couldn't get past itself, and that's one way, one more reason why it lost the war. All right, real quick here. Fundamentally, And this segues into what our next episode is going to be on. But fundamentally, the reason why the South lost its war, or lost the Civil War, was because over the course of the war, and especially at Sherman's March to the Sea, the South could no longer maintain its way of life. When Sherman marched from Atlanta to Georgia, he set a precedent that he did in the Carolinas later. We remember Sherman's March to the Sea because there's actually a really famous poem talking about the, you know, March to the Sea. But in Sherman's own words, his Carolinas campaign was actually more devastating than what his Georgia campaign was. What Sherman did was, you know, you burn all the barns, you remove all the food, you free all the slaves, you rip up all the railroads, you prevent the states from reinforcing one another, from communicating with one another, and you completely just obliterated its ability to wage war. You know, those plantation owners, it's like, you don't have a plantation anymore. Like, your way of life is over. And when all your slaves are gone because this army came and they freed your slaves, they requisitioned your horses and your cattle, and you don't have a farm anymore because it's burning. You don't have a market because, you know, a market in Atlanta, a market in Wilmington, a market in Augusta, a market in Columbia, a market in Mobile. Like, you can't do anything with it, with your stuff, because it's on fire. Your agricultural way of life is gone. And from a more, not an ethical moral, but like a morale standpoint, it's like, why am I fighting? The way of life that I sought to defend is gone. Just some quick facts here on just the impact that Sherman's strategy had on just the Southern way of life. There was a really interesting study done, I believe it was actually done in 2020, or maybe right before COVID. It was published in 2020. Basically says that, like, Sherman's March to the Sea so severely crippled the Southern economy that its effects were still being felt in the 1920s, and that it's difficult after the, you know, once the Great Depression occurred, it's difficult to kind of determine, okay, what's Sherman's March to the Sea versus what's Great Depression. But it's like, there were, the Southern economy was still very much like disadvantaged, if not completely non-existent in certain places. Because of what Sherman did.
Yeah. If any of our listeners have ever had a chance to go visit like a Savannah, Charleston, New Orleans, any of these Southern cities, Wilmington, the architecture, you can go into all of these old buildings, and they were built in some as early as the 1600s, most of them 1700s, 1800s. But the reason they have not modernized like a New York or Boston or some of these others, where the overwhelming majority of the city has changed, it's because these cities were too poor. Like, there are some buildings in Charleston that didn't even have a real roof over them because they were too poor to put a roof on them. So it wasn't until the 20s and after the Depression that they decided, hey, let's keep these buildings because it can become something what's already here. We can't build a new building. Let's repair it. And eventually it became like a tourism thing. But like, they were so poor, they couldn't replace buildings. They were still, I think in Charleston, I remember it was part of a class I took freshman year. Like, part of the buildings were in Charleston still had damage from the Civil War on the outskirts of the city, because Charleston was never overrun. You know, but they definitely didn't have roofs or anything like that. And if you go to any of the plantations around, like Boone Hall, Middleton Place, which Middleton Place is famous from the Patriots, where they were having their party and the ship blew up on the river. It's interesting about that guy, like, talking about the way of life being ruined. Like, one of his houses was burned down. The actual only house remaining was like a wing. But he traded all of his money for Confederate dollars. Like, all of his resources were poured into Confederate dollars. And it's like, by 1864, when there's no markets, nothing's being done, it's like, it doesn't matter how much wealth you have in Confederate dollars because none of them are being spent. Nothing can be bought with it, so it's worthless. And now I'm basically no longer this wealthy plantation owner and this important man in the Confederacy. I am basically broke. And I have no slaves, yeah. I have no money, I have no resources anymore. So two kind of anecdotal tidbits on that.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. The, you know, the South, we're still on the gold standard. And the South had no gold. So the only way that it could finance its war was to just print money. And hyperinflation took hold very quickly. And yeah, it's like, even if you could get something to market and to sell, like the money was worthless. And yeah, like there were all these various, you know, they tried to raise bonds and there's all kinds of things. Anyway, all this served to just the Southern way of life that it so fiercely fought to defend had been taken from them in a very real way. Honestly, and I think that should evoke some sympathy, not necessarily for the slavery aspect. Obviously, I'm not trying to say that, they weren't allowed to have slaves anymore, so we should feel sorry for them. That's not what I'm trying to say. But when, you know, when you have your way of life and it's completely gone, and I mean comprehensively gone, like the house you've grown up in, the you know, all your friends died in the war, like these things, your morale obviously tanks because there's nothing left to fight for. And with that, that kind of covers, you know, this episode has been focused really on answering like why the South lost the war. It wasn't meant to be like a recap of how the Civil War occurred and what went down. You know, we stayed very big picture on the conduct of the war itself. And we really tried to focus on, okay, what were the things that caused the South to win the war? We tried to look at a few different perspectives and engage with that. The next and final episode of this little mini series is going to look at Reconstruction because, you know, first episode, arguing for the existence of the Old South, second episode, talking about the destruction of the Old South. Reconstruction is why the Old South never came back. And even to this day, there are wounds over how Reconstruction was handled. And I would include as a part of Reconstruction, like the narrative for what happened, like why the Civil War happened, how it happened, and, you know, why they lost. You know, I mentioned the Lost Cause. That was immediately in 1866. Like that's, you know, that story, telling ourselves as Americans that story of what happened is very much a part of Reconstruction. You know, we'll talk about radical republicanism. We'll talk about, you know, how Confederate generals were pardoned. You know, we'll talk about how carpetbaggers and, you know, those damned Yankees coming down to the South to, you know, exploit. We'll talk about freedmen and the Freedmen's Bureau. We'll talk about, you know, how Reconstruction led to the Civil Rights era and Jim Crow laws. And we'll talk about the political shifts, about how McPherson actually makes a really good argument for prior to the Civil War, the South dominated Washington, D.C. politics, and how like the majority of presidents, the majority of speakers of the House, the majority of appointed Supreme Court justices all came from Southern states before the Civil War. And after that, it wasn't even close. It was a complete flip-flop from Northern states being Republicans, et cetera. We'll talk about Andrew Johnson, and, you know, how he tried and how Grant, you know, ultimately what came of him. So that's going to be like why the South didn't rise again. and that'll kind of be the closing act in this tragic drama for the fall of the antebellum South.
Jay, thanks. That was a great episode. I really enjoyed hearing your composition and take on why the South fell. I think it's an interesting topic, especially now considering that there's, thanks to Nikki Haley and maybe some political missteps, bringing up the why the Civil War was fought and Confederate memorials being torn down. I think it is important to understand the Civil War, why it was fought, why the South lost, why the North won, all of these different factors, because at the end of the day, the North did win, the Union was preserved, and now it is part of our shared history, and it is important to understand, lest we ever repeat it, considering all of the Civil War 2.0 talks going on right now, which you might be able to take with a grain of salt, but it's interesting that it's come up again, even at all, right? But, you know, with all that being said, if you like what Jay and I are doing, give us a like, a follow, subscribe on YouTube. We're really starting to hit our stride on YouTube. So it's an interesting platform that we're just now really starting to post on. We're on Instagram. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook under Variations of Loins of History. We love getting your feedback, emails, DMs, whatever. If you have some constructive criticism or you just want to give us you know, just some regular feedback that we're doing a great job, and a review or a 5-star on Spotify, Apple Podcast. We'll give you a shout out on the next episode. And I will be able to announce, Jay, what empire I'll be talking about next week. So stay tuned for that as well. All right. Well, thank you. And look forward to talking to you next week on the Loins of History. Thank you.